Hello, and welcome to the Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zelman, and today we have a real treat. Now, you hear the phrase internet pioneer and web pioneer often enough in our industry, but today we really have one with us. Just listen to these credits. Glenn Davis is the creator of Cool Site of the Day, co-founder of Project Cool, and co-founder, executive committee member, and essayist for the Web Standards Project, which he also hosted. Glenn was a leading force behind Liquid Design, an approach to web design that tries to be webby and that predates responsive web design by about 20 years. And he taught everyone, including me, how to do DHTML, if you remember those words together, DHTML, via his Project Cool tutorials. In the Silicon Valley of the early to mid-1990s through the early 2000s, he was a huge creative force, and like many other pioneers, at some point he left. Glenn, welcome to the show.
Thank you. That was some introduction. Very unexpected. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure, and this is probably long overdue. You wrote in the second issue of A List Apart, with in 1998, and you were the voice of the WASP. If anyone remembers the Web Standards Project's voice, you had a column called Word from the WASP. You want to?
Yes, that was me. That was me being, oh gosh, people thought I was pretty harsh in those essays. They were rants. They were designed to get attention, and we needed attention back then.
It's amazing to me how much attention we got, considering what a strange non-commercial message we had going,
right? Yes, indeed. It really was. And the browser, well, okay, I say the browser vendors didn't want to listen to us, but really, Microsoft didn't want to listen to us more than anyone else. And it was very frustrating.
Maybe we should explain to folks who weren't doing web design back then what it was like for a professional web developer in 1997, 1998.
Well, it was a nightmare because we had different browsers supporting different parts of the standards. You would have to basically design two different websites, check to see which browser was coming in, and modify accordingly. Now, you still have to do a little bit of that today, but not nearly like we had to then, and it was getting worse. These two companies were on the committee ratifying the standards, and they weren't following the standards.
Why was that?
Well, with Microsoft, they said it was their customers didn't want them.
Right.
Netscape, I think they were just – their engine at the time was becoming unwieldy. And as new things were coming out, it was becoming harder and harder in Netscape Navigator to – add these things to it. In fact, they ended up having to create a new engine they called Gecko. And Gecko was the standards compliant engine. I remember the first copy I ever received of it actually fit on a floppy disk. Can you imagine a web browser fitting on a floppy disk?
Yeah, because you didn't want to download all 600K or whatever. That would take too long. That would take too long. That would take all night.
We had 2400 baud modems.
Yeah. It's weird. I think initially Netscape didn't feel they needed to worry about standards because initially they dominated the market and they didn't really see – IE didn't exist and I don't think they saw Opera as a threat.
No.
I mean, you know, Mark Andreessen made up tags, right? He made up the image tag.
Right, and that oh-so-famous Blink tag. Remember that?
Yeah, I loved the Blink tag. And then there was Marquee, and we would we would use Marquee to move text on our page and Blink to make it flash. And if you were being a browser aware developer, you would use both tags. but those are jokes. But I mean, it was the way they did scripting languages was different. The way they interpreted different parts of CSS incorrectly was different. I mean,
right.
And Microsoft actually had a better CSS box model than the actual CSS box model.
They did.
Which we can finally use, but that took 15 years.
It took forever. It was ridiculous. For me, the big thing with Microsoft was they kept asking us, well, which part of the standard do we need to support? And we would say, all of it. And they would say, well, which part of the standard do we need to support? And it was like a broken record here.
Yeah. Do you, Eric Meyer, who I do a conference with, I think the first time we met was when he was on the 7 CSS Samurai. Do you remember those folks?
Him, Todd Farnham, and a few others I can't remember the names of.
Yeah, which we've just offended people who turned into the show. But yeah, no, but they were basically people who understood CSS before it was implemented, which is kind of amazing.
Oh, they were an incredible team.
Yeah, just geniuses, really. Because I mean, do you remember when you were learning? You sprang out of nowhere, fully formed, right, in like 1995.
1994
with Cool Site of the Day, which was the first thing I remember seeing on the web that was cool and that was different from the typical website of 1994, which was some text of varying sizes in a default font.
Well, yeah, we didn't even have colors.
Right.
Basically, what we had was an outliner. We had an outliner on the web, and everything was left justified, and you could do some indentation, and you could separate paragraphs with a space, and it was all black, and links were blue, and it was on a gray background, about 777, I think.
Yeah.
Was probably the value of it. And we could put an image on there, and that was really about it.
Because Mark Anderson had shipped the image tag.
Right, he put it on the Mosaic browser from NCSA.
Right, there was a huge discussion about it where Tim Berners-Lee was being thoughtful and going, maybe we want to call it object, but then again we might have this other use case. And then Mark Anderson said, yeah, it's called image, we just shipped it, is the way I've heard the story. But so when you were doing Cool Site of the Day in 1994, what was cool and how did you, what were your criteria for what was cool?
Well, I was always looking for things that pushed the limits. My feeling was that people had to be inspired, and it was difficult to find anything. I mean, you could go to NCSA's What's New page and you could find all of this stuff, and most of it was pretty lame stuff. People putting their businesses online as outlines, resumes, things like that. Sometimes you'd get fan sites, fans of certain things that they would put up.
Those were my favorites. Fan sites were cool.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah.
They were. And I would look for things that were different, things that pushed the envelope, things that showed different ways of thinking about the web, things we could do with it, because I didn't want the web to turn into just a commercial entity that was just present your store. I mean, I remember my boss, he was really excited about stores. He wanted to have an online mall, and it was going to be called the Aardvark Mall, because Aardvark has two A's in it and therefore ensures it's at the top of lists.
Wow, at the top of the Yahoo list, which was how people would find stuff, because Google hadn't been invented.
Right.
And search was terrible to the extent
search
that it even
terrible.
Existed. Yeah, so.
Yeah, we had Yahoo, we had, what else did we have? Eventually, we had AltaVista.
Oh, yeah. That was the first powerful search engine I can remember.
Right.
It still exists.
It does?
Yeah, it still exists as something.
That's interesting. I used their software at one point for the second iteration of DevSearch. Wasn't terribly thrilled with their software, though.
It looks like Yahoo bought them.
Yeah?
It seemed to me that Yahoo bought a lot of stuff and killed it, or Yahoo would buy stuff that was already in decline and it would hasten its decline. But yeah, so if you go to altavista.com, it redirects to search.yahoo.com from AltaVista. So they're keeping track of the fact that you're a dinosaur that was looking for AltaVista. But
indeed, you are a dinosaur if you're going to that URL.
Yeah, but
there was a lot of that.
Yeah. What do you think about projects like the Internet Archives?
I love the idea of the Internet Archive, to me, what's disappointing, though, is that to really utilize it fully, you have to have an older browser to visit it with, and you can't run the older browsers well on modern machines.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I look at things and think, gee, did this really look like this? But no, the type was pixelated. There's no way. There's no way to see what it looked like. There were some things that looked really good. And yes, that is the pixel size that of Verdana that was set, but it doesn't look like on a high def screen of today. With you know, it doesn't look the same as it did when it was filling half your screen and pixelated.
Mm-hmm. And the dynamic HTML and the JavaScript and the CSS doesn't look the same. JavaScript doesn't actually even work.
Right. When you started doing JavaScript, it was a choice. It was something Netscape supported and Microsoft didn't. They had a different language.
They called it ECMAScript, didn't they? They had their own language.
JScript.
Yeah, JScript.
It's a long time.
JScript, and it was similar to JavaScript, but it wasn't quite JavaScript.
Just different enough that it wouldn't work.
Right.
Did you expect Microsoft to win the browser wars when they first came on the scene?
No, I didn't. I did not, because we were doing all these cool things with Netscape Navigator, and then Microsoft came in and they started doing some pretty cool things. I went to one of their Learn to Use Our Browser conferences and learned some of the things you could do, and it was pretty interesting, but the compatibility was way gone.
I loved their support for CSS and their early support for CSS. I mean, possibly it was a cynical move. Possibly at the time they were just looking for an advantage, but mm-hmm. to me, in my mind, they found one when Netscape 3 made a decision. Yeah, we've got our own styles. We'll use those. And IE3 said, "Well, here's style sheets, and we've commissioned these graphic artists." This is how old it was. We've commissioned these graphic artists to make these web pages that looked amazing. That were like, you know, a few bytes of code because it was just CSS. But you suddenly had these like full color pages with giant type, with shadows and all this stuff. Do you remember the name of that? It was just like the CSS Wonderland or the CSS Workshop or the...
Oh, I know what you're talking about. I don't remember the name. Yeah, I'll remember it later, I'm sure.
It was 1996. I saw that and then I went out and got Steve Mulder's book on CSS. This is before I had met you. And of course I followed you and knew your work, but we hadn't really done anything together yet. But I got so psyched about CSS immediately after seeing that. And
well, we all did. I mean,
yeah,
control over type. Yeah. That's what we wanted. It was amazing.
It was amazing. And it seemed like plenty.
Uh-huh.
And we're still not fully exploiting what it could do.
No, we're not.
Do you keep up with emerging CSS? Like, do you look at CSS grid, you know, grid layout, or have you tried playing with Flexbox, or are you just not into it these days?
Well, I haven't really looked at doing anything on the web for a couple years now, until recently when we started talking. And then I went out. I listened to another one of your podcasts, and I learned about Flexbox.
Was that with Rachel Andrew?
No. Sazzy?
Sarah Parmeter. Yes, she loves that too. Yes.
And I went to her site and then followed some of the links. And I'm sitting there. I'm sitting there and my jaw's dropping on the floor.
So
and
different.
I'm thinking, this is what I wanted then.
Yes. Yes, it
took. This is what I was aiming for. This is what I saw us going toward. And it was, oh my gosh, so easy, like it should be.
That's wonderful. Now, why do you think it took so long?
I think we got tied up in, a lot of times we get tied up in what we can do and pushing the limits of what we can do that we stop inventing new things.
Yes. I think that's happening now. If you look at the web now, I think there's a lot of, and I've had other folks on the show talking about it, but there's a lot of sameness right now. We're sort of at this plateau of what we can do, and we're so enthralled with what we can do that everybody's basically designing the same site with the same three or four tricks.
Right. And it happens. The cycle repeats itself.
That happened before.
Mm-hmm. It happened multiple times in the 90s.
Let's talk about some of the 90s stuff that folks may not be aware of. But do you remember the title hack?
Oh, yeah. The title hack was great. We didn't have tabs. All we had was multiple windows, and we had a title bar. And there was a bug in Navigator that let us repeat the title tag multiple times, and we could put animations in the title bar. And we goofed around with it and did silly things like putting sharks swimming back and forth with the fin above the water and things like that, and spelling words out just by putting a string of title tags down the document. We might put 50 title tags, and it'd be a 50-frame animation that would play on the user's browser. And it was silly.
It was great fun. I did it too. Like I was always refreshing my home page's splash screen, right? Because everybody was going to look at the splash screen before digging into my architecture to find my content. But I remember like typing a Z and then like moving the Z. The effect was that the name of the site assembled itself, like in a very cheesy, cartoony way. And I do miss that wonderful, playful experimentation that we had when it was just, I mean, people have called it the Wild West.
Well, I know people would refresh the Project Cool homepage again and again and again. The second iteration of Project Cool, we had the menus there and the title. Now, they were all, the title was a Photoshop rendering of a font because we couldn't do fonts
right.
Very well. Couldn't do the font I wanted. And then behind all of this, the planet Saturn comes down from the corner of the screen, the upper left corner of the screen, and moves and covers part of the screen. And people were just floored by this. And they would sit there and they would refresh my homepage. I would have people sit there all day and just refresh my homepage to watch that. It was wonderful.
I stole that code.
Oh, I told people to.
Yeah.
I put in the comments of my pages, steal this code.
I remember that.
Make it your own.
I remember that. You were always an educator.
Yeah. And that was the whole point of everything I did.
How did you come to start Cool Site of the Day? Again, I don't know. I think for some listeners, that's going to be incredibly juicy nostalgia to remember that. And for others, it's just going to be a strange set of words. But Cool Site of the Day was the first thing that I ever saw where you were going to be entertained. You were going to click a link and be entertained.
Well, what was happening was I was so excited about the web. I was so incredibly excited about the web as in a graphic interface. To me, it was just incredible. And I was running, I was surfing the entire web, everything that I could. And in that day, you could see most of the web if you really set your mind to it. Because the web was a very small thing then. And I would find these really cool things, and I would run around to people in the office, and I would say, hey, you got to see this. Hey, you got to see that. And one of my bosses said, wouldn't it be fun if you could show people that every day?
Now, what were you working as?
I was...
A sysadmin?
Sort of. I was kind of, I don't know what my actual title was. I was...
At a hosting company, though, right?
At a hosting company, yes. What had happened was I was going into – I wasn't working because of an injury to my foot, and I discovered they had a text-based interface to the internet in my area. So I was using this interface and exploring the internet. But I was taking up one of their phone lines. I went in and I plunked down a full year for their service, but I was taking up one of their phone lines. But – I was learning so much, and I asked them if anything needed to be done. And they said, well, could you rebuild our Gopher server? Now, for those who don't know what Gopher was the web before it became the web. Gopher was a series of lines on a sheet of paper, basically, and each line was a link to something. And so it was just a menu. All Gopher was a menu. And you would go to one menu item, and it would lead to another Gopher server, and eventually you would get the content. And it was just going up and down a static menu. So I redesigned all of the options on their Gopher server. And then I went into their office, started going into their offices to do volunteer work for them, because I just loved the internet and where it was going. And I wanted to be as close to it as possible. So then they needed their ASCII interface reworked. So I rewrote their ASCII interface.
Now, were you a programmer? Had you studied programming?
I was a self-taught programmer. Got it. I started using computers in 1980 with the TRS-80 Model 1. And then my first computer was an Atari 800XL, and I taught myself how to program on those machines and on subsequent machines going up. But this Unix thing was a whole new thing, and it was exciting. And they had the machines that answered the phone for people to dial into, the dial-in boxes. I forget what they were called, what company they were. But they had the capability to do a slip connection, which is serial link IP. So you could conceivably have a graphic interface to the internet if you connect via a slip or a PPP connection.
Right.
Now, they said that they couldn't do both that and have a text-based interface on their machine, so I took the manuals home. And then without telling them, I reconfigured one of their machines. And then I called them into their office, unplugged them a Sun workstation from the Ethernet. No, actually, it was a PC, unplugged it from the Ethernet, plugged it into a modem, dialed up their host service, and showed them Mosaic running on an IBM PC using their equipment. Wow. And they hired me.
Wow.
And I did all kinds of things. I did a lot of sysadmin work, but really what I was interested in was building their website. And that's what they hired me to do, was build their website.
So your first website that you built was like 1994?
Yeah.
And what did it look like, and how did it – I mean, there wasn't much it could look like.
I really don't remember what it looked like, actually. But
I'm guessing that it was gray in Netscape.
Well, yeah. And Mosaic. That's what it was.
It was Mosaic. Gray and had blue links.
And Cello. Do you remember Cello?
Was that the two-way browser?
That was a different browser that was available for the PC, because
that might be before my time.
NCSA, in their ultimate wisdom, decided that if any ISPs wanted to give away a web browser, they would have to license Mosaic for $20,000.
Oh my gosh.
And so ISPs gave away Cello, which didn't need to be licensed, which had a yellow background and black text. And pictures.
And then Mark Anderson and his partners, they released Netscape, which
right,
was
they
basically
broke off
Mosaic for sale.
Yeah, Netscape's first name was Mosaic Communications Corporation.
Right, with that beautiful and
Mosaic,
dragon.
NCSA had a fit about that and made them change their name. And then they released Netscape. And Netscape was it. Netscape was where to be. So I started the Project Cool thing, or not the Project Cool thing, the Cool Site of the Day thing,
right.
And I would just feature a site every day. And every day I would look for a new one to put up for the next day.
Did you know it was going to bring huge traffic?
I had no idea it was going to bring huge traffic. I used to say I crashed web servers for a living, because that's what I did.
Wow.
I would pick a site, and the audience would go in droves to see what I'd picked that day.
That was maybe the first, I mean, now we call it viral, but maybe that was the first viral thing, right? There was.
It may have been. It may have been. I always consider myself the web's first critic.
Yes, I remember that phrase.
Oh, I didn't actually criticize, other right. than the fact that I picked something and everybody wanted me to pick them.
I remember that. There was another. Soon after you, there was websites that sucked. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Which is a very different approach.
Uh-huh.
And soon after that, and that websites that suck was basically...
That was an easy job, because most of the websites sucked.
Yeah. It was the opposite of Cool Site of the Day. Right.
Right.
It was, let's go after these really lame sites with bad content and bad design. And I think he was trying to teach as well, though. He was definitely trying to teach. because there were, like, you know, lessons, like, if I can't even imagine what kind of usability problems you could have had back then, because it wasn't possible. It was not like you could turn off link underlining so that he could make a moral about it. I mean, by the time Jacob Nielsen came along, you already had the ability to do some things, even if it was just with inline CSS in a tag. Do you remember right. that? Like turning off a link color in the tag. And JavaScript was inline in a tag. In fact, some places it still is, which is like mind blowing. But yeah, I remember the first time I used JavaScript, I had basically a link to a pound sign, right? A link to nothing. And then wrote JavaScript colon and some stuff I stole from you or somebody or from, what were some of the big, let's see. There were a couple of tutorial magazines. There was Hotwired WebMonkey.
WebMonkey.
Which was pretty good.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember?
They were pretty good about low bandwidth stuff.
Yes.
Low bandwidth was key back then because you were talking 10 minutes a megabyte to download something.
It's key again now. And people are just coming to terms with it because, like you said at the beginning, everything's a cycle.
Do you remember how fast the servers were then? 1.5 megabits per second was a T1 line.
Yes, that was.
And that's what everybody wanted. They wanted their server on a T1 line.
That was unimaginable luxury.
It was. It was incredible.
But we designed to be low bandwidth. And we were
we were designing pages that were in the kilobytes.
And had to be. Had to be.
And because people were calling them up on dial-up modems. And so they had to load quickly. And we do these little tricks. Like I had this one little trick I called perceived bandwidth.
Wow.
Because I felt like you had to convince the user that it was going faster than it really was. And the way conceived bandwidth worked was originally we had these things called image maps. You remember image maps?
I do remember image maps. It was a big picture of a website.
It was a links, big picture.
With links built
You would define where the links were in the map, and people could click those parts of the picture and go to links.
Right.
So one of the things that I did for whenever something like that was called for was I would break that up. I would cut that picture up into multiple pieces, and those pictures would be loading – those multiple pieces would all be loading at the same time. And although it took the same amount of time to load the picture, people perceived that it was loading faster.
Because they could
perceive bandwidth.
Because they could see sort of
something happening.
Yes, that makes perfect sense.
That's
still a thing. That's a thing in modern web development. I was just at a lecture by Laura Hogan where she was talking about, one way of doing this, like using sprites, right? And the sprite actually is slower to load because it's a bigger image, but there are fewer HTTP calls, so. It's perceived as quicker, although it's actually slower. I'm doing a terrible job of explaining that, but Laura Hogan does a very good job of explaining
it. Well, I understand perfectly
And it's the same thing that you're talking about. It's that sleight of hand.
Perception is everything.
I'm really glad people are talking about this again, although the kids think they invented it, which is fun.
Oh, yeah.
I was also at a lecture where I was being told that you could blur the background of a JPEG. To make it load faster. I was like, yes, I've known that for 20 years, but I saw people were taking notes like, this is a new thing. Because it is new.
Well, the problem is that there is no real central repository of knowledge for web design.
Yes.
And because there's no central repository, people go different places. I had this concept in the 90s that I called the bubbles in the web. And it all started because of this series of websites about lounge music. There were a lot of lounge music websites out there, and I like lounge music. And I was visiting some of the websites, and they were trying to be in the style of lounges and things, but they were a bubble. If you couldn't find your way into that bubble, you wouldn't know that they existed. And
right.
They were self-referential, so they were all pointing to each other, but they weren't pointing outside of the bubble. So you would find these bubbles in the web.
If someone told you about one, you could then find five or six others.
Right.
But if you never discovered one, you wouldn't discover any of them. They weren't findable.
Exactly.
They weren't findable.
And I've noticed that a lot of the web design resources seem to be the same way.
Well, yeah, that's definitely true. Yeah. If you follow this person, you'll follow that other person and that other person. And if you don't know about the first one, you're not going to know about the other two.
Yeah, and then there'll be these other people out there that don't know about these guys. But they've got their own little bubble.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Again, I run a conference and I have speakers that I know and that I've known for a long time, and I'm always finding new ones, but I'm in a bubble of people who think a certain way,
right,
and design a certain way, and we sort of see people, you know, people making interesting arguments in that little community, and then I'll get the delusion, oh, I know the web community. I know the web design community. No, I don't. I know a little tiny piece of it.
You know a bubble of it.
I know a bubble of it. Yes. Yes. I'm going to take – this is very good. Stay warm. Stay hot. I love what we're talking about. I have to take a quick sponsor break, so hang in there. Okay, because we couldn't do this show without our sponsor. This episode of The Big Web Show is brought to you by Braintree Payments. By next year, maybe even next week, there could be a whole new way to pay. Maybe it will be the next Bitcoin or the next Apple Pay, or maybe even both. Fortunately, Braintree's full-stack payment platform is easily adaptable to whatever the future holds, so you can easily adapt too. Accept everything from pounds to PayPal to that next big innovation from any device with just one integration. That rhymes. And when that new payment method comes out, all you'll have to do is update a few lines of code. No late nights, no complicated recoding, no stress about staying ahead of the curve. Braintree Payments is here to help. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/bigwebshow. That's braintreepayments.com/bigwebshow. And we are back with Glenn Davis, internet pioneer extraordinaire. Do you remember, Glenn? Was Cool Site of the Day initially a Tilda site? In other words?
No, it wasn't a Tilda site.
So it was always CoolSiteOfTheDay.com?
No, it wasn't. It was the host, Infinet, infi.net/cool.
That's
and I put it right off of their main website.
That's right. That's what I was trying to remember. Okay, yes. Yeah, so you couldn't just type CoolSiteOfTheDay.com in your browser window.
No.
And you, today, in most browsers, you can type in the window, and if the URL isn't recognized, it goes into search automatically. But that wasn't an option either.
Oh, that certainly wasn't an option.
And that has its downsides, too. If you've ever tried typing the name of a company you want to visit, you type the URL, and then you get a search page with that listed as – and, you know.
And I've done it. It's like, I wanted to go there. Just take me there.
Just take me there. Okay, you know, now the company will be charged a few cents if I click that link. So I'm going to go try to find that same link lower down in the search results where you're not being charged for. It's just like extra, you know, a lot of things dumbing down. I don't like the phrase dumbing down, but in making the web easier and easier for most folks to understand who aren't obsessive compulsive nerds, we've done some damage too. I, for instance, the idea of obscuring a URL or only showing the domain name, not the whole URL. That just doesn't, that stuff doesn't rub me the right way.
It's like, no, it doesn't me either. I want to bookmark a particular piece of this, but I can't do that.
Yeah.
But we started that.
How?
We started that when we were given frames.
Yes. Okay.
Do you remember the nightmare that was frames?
Guilt and shame.
The glory that was frames?
Frames and iframes. I do. I do. I'd forgotten.
Iframes are still out there. They're still used today.
Although you can do the same thing with CSS.
Right.
With less damage.
Right.
Yeah.
But
for frames, for people who don't remember or weren't there.
Well, okay, well, there's my list of menu items on the left side of the screen or the right side of the screen. I always preferred the right side of the screen. And I click something, and then there it loads on the left side of the screen, and it fills the window, but my menu stays there. basic concept to us today through CSS.
Right.
It was revolutionary when they gave us frames in the 90s.
Now it's so abused that instead of, if there's a gallery of photos, instead of going from one page to the next and bookmarking the third photo because it's got its own unique URL, everything ends up in a light box.
Right.
And I don't know if I'm bookmarking the photo that I liked.
Or simply the gallery.
Or simply the gallery, right. So if I'm sending this, hey, get a load of this, I don't know if I'm actually sending my friend the picture I want them to see or
not. Yeah, you have to actually check it and make sure.
And I can't download it or save it, as we used to be able to do, because the Lightbox prevents that. It was always, back then, there were people right away. I mean, do you remember this? You'd have a client who'd say, I want people to be able to see my photos, but not be able to download them. Or I want people to be able to read my copy, but not be able to copy and paste. And be like, that's not... I'd be very...
All right, go write a book.
I'd be very evangelical. Say, you know what? Even if I could do that, if I knew a way to do that, I wouldn't do that, because that's not what this is.
Mm-hmm.
The
other thing in the 90s was how open source everything was.
Yes.
I mean, you wanted people to look at your code. At least I did, and other people I knew did.
Absolutely.
I wanted people to take my code and build from it. And people do so much to obfuscate their code now.
There's still a lot of sharing in our community, but it depends who, right? So there's lots of companies that deliberately share, here's this innovation we've just come up with, here's how it works, here it is on CodePen, or here it is on GitHub, download it, play with it, make it your own. That still goes on, but yeah, if you try to view source on some sites now where they have minification and seven other things going on, it's pretty impossible to know what it is. And if I were a new person trying to learn HTML today, I'd be terrified. And I think it's sad that we've obscured the brilliance of the web, which is that anyone can learn to do it, and that it's just a few tags and that they make sense, right? And you layer up from there. Mm-hmm. Everything should work for everybody, and you layer up from there.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how the web works. Yeah, and that's how the web works. By its definition, that's how the web works. It's a universal communication service, right? So why do we then make it so difficult for people to access our stuff and then complain about the web?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And people go, I much prefer apps because the web, man, doesn't really do all this. Like, it does. But I want to do all this fancy stuff. Well, you can.
Yeah, apps many times are written in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript.
That's all you need. That's still all you need. Right, but there's a way to do it, and there's a way to do it so that if people don't have JavaScript, it still works. I mean, we used to call it fallbacks, graceful degradation, which was always a strange phrase, I thought. And I prefer Steve Champion's phrase and way of looking at it of a progressive enhancement.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about some of the characters that we worked with, Dory Smith and Jeff Veen and Steve Champion. Yeah, just some amazing folks that helped form the Web Standards Project.
Yeah. Do you remember how the Web Standards Project got started?
So there was an email on a list. Initially, I think it was just George Olson and you.
Right.
And you brought in some other people.
Yeah, what happened was I saw an article. Netscape was quoted and said, we won't be able to support these new standards. And it really ticked me off. So I sent that email on that list. It was a private list in people don't even know about mailing lists anymore.
Right.
It was a San Francisco-based mailing list, basically. And George Olson picked up on it. And it just kind of – then we dragged you in and – it just kind of picked up steam, and we became the Web Standards Project. And we decided to go to bat to get standards in our web browsers.
Well, there were a bunch of names kicked around. But I remember that we landed on web standards, A, because of WASP.
You're right. WASP was such a great visual image.
Of, you know, one little WASP doesn't seem like it could hurt you, but you get a bunch of them mad, and you're in a lot of trouble. And that was sort of our... that was our David and Goliath analogy for we were, you know, very small and these companies were very big. These were, well, I don't know. Well, Microsoft was always big, But I don't know if Netscape, by today's standards, would be considered big, because now if it's not like a $5 billion company, it's nothing. But but back then it was a very powerful company, and we were just, you know, people it doing – I mean, I was doing a $5,000 web design job. It wasn't exactly someone to take on a company like that, but enough of us saying enough smart things made a difference. I think the browser makers, I think the engineers at the browser companies were on our side and wanted to do what we wanted to do. Otherwise, this wouldn't have worked. You know.
Unfortunately, I was dealing with the managers more than anything. I mean, I flew up to see Microsoft, spend a couple days with them, and all they wanted from me was, well, what specific standards? And I said that earlier, all of them.
But that's why in our manifesto, it was like HTML2 or whatever it was, CSS 1.0, and ECMAScript. Mm-hmm. Right? It was like right here, just these. Here's this little baseline, right? Because – and correctly and completely was another phrase that we came up with, right? Because it didn't – if you do it incorrectly, what's the point? If you do it differently, what's the point? If you do some of it and then you work on colored scroll bars, what's the point? Mm-hmm. Like, do this first. I remember the managers didn't like it because their directive from the bosses was, we're going to own the internet.
Well, right? they told me, their excuse to me was that their customers didn't want it.
Right.
And I said, well, we're your customers. No, our customers are the Fortune 500 companies who all use us on their intranets. They're the people we pay attention to.
Absolutely. And I think that was true. But I also believe the people above them, right? So they had to care about those customers, right? That was the bottom line. But especially when Internet Explorer was giving it away, to say that they cared about their customers, yes and no. Yes, you were selling a lot of Windows installs, but you were giving away the browser. So really, did you really? I mean, yes and no. Yes, you were trying to sell a whole ecosystem. I think Netscape seemed like a threat. Netscape and Java seemed like a threat. So Microsoft got in the game and said, no, we're going to own this. And then they both...
We're going to do it our way.
And they competed as software companies, right? Like Macromedia versus Adobe, if you remember Macromedia. Like,
oh, I definitely remember Macromedia.
They were a great company. They were a great company. Do you ever talk to any Adobe folks or...
No, I've lost contact with everybody.
Huh. By choice?
More just by obscurity. I mean, I left the public eye. I was no longer doing that thing that they wanted. And therefore, I just kind of faded into obscurity.
There's something about designers and developers on the web that reminds me of rock musicians.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like...
If you keep that's always been the case.
If you keep having hits, you're okay. And in the minute you stop, you know, the hell with you. Which is sad. And it's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of pressure to try to stay relevant, right? As a designer, as a service provider, whatever it is that you do, because it's always changing. Well, do you remember the introduction of the GIF and the animated GIF?
I'm laughing because we pronounce it differently, because that's one of the long-standing arguments. Yes, I remember the GIF in the introduction.
A GIF is how it should be pronounced. I only pronounce it GIF because the inventor did.
Right.
And I just learned about it so long ago that I remember reading that and going like, oh.
It's just like I always call it Linux because it was Linus who created Linux.
Sure.
But everyone calls it Linux.
Right. If he does, then they're right. I don't know.
No, he calls it Linux.
Okay, so then they're wrong. But but you don't want to feel like an idiot standing up in front of people saying, yeah, I know.
Right.
Everyone makes fun of me for that.
But yeah, the GIF was wonderful, especially when we – well, it could be smaller. And oh, my gosh. Limiting it. Remember when we had to limit it to web colors?
Yes.
And so we'd have these dithered images that were limited to web colors.
But that was one of the reasons I fell in love with the web. It was my first web project. It was batmanforever.com, as I often say. And still, 20 years later, I still talk about it. But I got this like 2 megabyte Photoshop file of, what's her name, the actress. She was married to Tom Cruise. She's an Australian actress, great actress. She's in a Kubrick film, blah, blah, blah.
Nicole Kidman.
Nicole Kidman, thank you, because I'm old and my brain is not working anymore. Nicole Kidman. So I got this 2 megabyte Photoshop file, and I got it down to like a 2K GIF. And you could still tell that it was Nicole Kidman, and she still looked beautiful. And I was like, this is amazing. And just playing with color and trying to squeeze every little pixel out of it, or going into type that you'd set in Photoshop and then trying to like just cut some of the blurriness out, like blowing it up, edge pixels, like shaving edge pixels, that weird craftsmanship that we don't have to do anymore, that it wouldn't make any difference if we did. But I loved that. I loved that. Like, it was kind of like work, just being at a tool, you know, in a tool shop, just working for hours, looking up and going, oh, I've been on the lathe all day.
Really? The transparency that we had.
The sharing that we had. Or do you mean the transparency?
No, I mean the actual transparency in the GIF.
Yes.
We could have an image that wasn't square.
But it was one color of transparency.
Right, right. So we couldn't do anti-aliasing unless we were being very careful with our background color.
Yes. So if it was like white, you could probably get away with stuff. Those things still show up. Sometimes you'll go to like Facebook. Do you use Facebook?
Unfortunately, yes.
Okay, and you'll sometimes see an image, like not a PNG, but a GIF where it was anti-aliased against a color, and then it shows up. You see all the horror. You see all this like early web horror on Facebook because it just reproduces the actual image as it was produced. What are your favorite? Are there websites that you like now? Are there web trends that you like now that you can see?
I have to say that it's interesting in that I will go out and I will surf the web sometimes for hours looking at new things. But there's a series of websites that I go to every day, and that's most of what I use the web for.
Okay.
I like to see the new things. I like to see what's going on. There's doesn't seem to be anything like what I did. In which there was a filter that would show the really great things, and I think that's sad. I think that
the bloom is off the rose. That maybe the luster for people that people take the internet for granted. They take the web for granted. They don't really think of it as the web. Everybody thinks of it as the internet, and they don't really separate between devices. I mean, most folks just think, you know, I'm using Facebook now, and it doesn't. They don't think I'm using it on the web or I'm using this app.
And most of the time, they're using it on the phone.
Right. But it still could be on the web or it could be an app. And people don't generally think about that. They just think about the brand they're interacting with.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Which is the challenge for designers now is like
coming
up with a cohesive experience.
Well, the fact that we now have a fully fledged responsive web as our capabilities is extraordinary. Because back in the day in the 90s, I was talking about the fact that people needed to not think about it being a web page.
Right.
You're going to a website because you want information, you want data, you want to learn something, you want to find something. And everything that told you it was a web page detracts from that. The browser shouldn't be something you even notice. It should be something that you use, and it's just fluid and seamless. And we can build pages now in which the fact that you're using a browser isn't apparent.
Right.
It was very difficult to do that in the 90s.
A lot of the stuff that you talked about has come true. It just took a long time. And this the emphasis on – I'd forgotten they said that, but yeah, this is not a page – it's not print. That's just one frame of reference for this, but really what you're doing is interacting with content. Really what you're doing is having an experience. That's what you kept saying. That's true now. I think it was true then, but our means of expression were so limited.
Very limited.
It was just hard to, it was hard to think five steps ahead when you were still just basically trying to get, like, could I make the skin not be orange? Right.
You were big on the color orange.
I loved orange. I love orange.
I've gotten a great appreciation of orange because of you.
Thank you. Although I've moved to red.
I have noticed that.
Red is my thing now. My new business site, my daughter calls it Mexican Red, which I think is really perceptive and nice because it does. It has sort of an Adobe quality to it.
Uh-huh.
Not Adobe the company, Adobe.
Right.
Adobe building material. The building material. At least on the devices and monitors that we've seen it, that's what it looks like. Who knows what it looks like on everybody else's machine?
That was the thing that drove me nuts in the 90s, was we had all of these print designers coming into the web, and they understood print design, and they could be brilliant print designers. And then they would design a page on a website, and it was print. The only difference was that you could click a link and go someplace. Other than that, it was print. So if you could print it on a piece of paper and you could make a book, but it didn't.
One of the things that frustrated me as a designer with the studio is that oftentimes we'd come in after a more famous graphic design shop had taken the first crack at branding, and they'd come up with this brand that was in no way going to work on the web. They'd come up with like a very complicated logo that really couldn't be reduced to a 16x16 fave icon. And so right. You go, yeah, I'm not sure what to do here. Or they'd say, no, it's very, this before web fonts, it's very important that we use this font. And I'm like, okay, so Courier, courier comes close. No. It's, you know, and I'd be like, I do understand what you're saying. I do know that type is important, but we don't have that option. And just, those were not arguments people understood. I mean, it took a long time for the graphic design community. They still, it's weird. There's still some incredibly talented, gifted, traditional graphic designers who are still sort of out of it when it comes to the web and interaction design generally. We sort of feel like they're still five or six steps behind, which is probably good for people like me who are not as talented as them, right? Because if they knew everything I know about the web and they could design as well as they do, I'd be out of a job completely. So I guess it's a good thing, but still.
Well, you know, it's the people that don't know that something's impossible that push the envelope.
Yes. Yes. And it's true that as you become more professional, you can fall into the trap of making what you've already made.
Right. And you forget to look beyond. You forget to step out of that box. You forget to say, hey,
that's an important,
let's try this.
That's an important message, and I'm glad you're saying it. I have wonderfully conflicting feelings about the standardization that is happening to design now. Not technological standards, but style guides and pattern libraries, which in some ways are fantastic, and they help bring order to chaos, the chaos of these giant sites that people, you know, that 50 developers work on over 20 years, and they're a mess. It's brilliant to bring in a style guide and say, okay, no, this is how we do a navigation box, and this is how we do it. These are the two-button styles, not the 50-button styles. Right. It's right. Great to have that standardization, but at the same time, there's also a dulling down as things get bigger.
It's also an homogenization.
Yes, it's an homogenization.
And there still need to be people out there that are trying to do the impossible things.
Well,
there still need to do people who say, I think I can do this. The people who look at that technology and say, hey, let's try this. And then they need some recognition of some sort when they do it.
So we may need another cool site of the day.
I think we may.
Well, this is a good note to go out on. It's been a real pleasure connecting with you again today. Let's not wait so long next time. And
there's a lot we didn't talk about. We will have to do this again.
We will have to do this again. Now, this has been an hour, a too short hour with Mr. Glenn Davis. co-founder of Project Cool, creator of Cool Side of the Gay, co-creator and driving force behind the Web Standards Project, and much, much more. Thank you, Glenn. Thanks, everybody.